Hello, everybody. Hi there, my It's All About Food listeners. I'm so happy to be here with you today. It has been quite a week, hasn't it? Did you get through Thanksgiving? We did, and it was super, super yummy. We baked up a lot of food. I think we talked about some of the food we were going to make for Thanksgiving last week. We did it all. There's typically one fail, though. Something always doesn't go right, right? And here's what didn't go right. I was so disappointed. Gary made an incredible polenta stuffing that we were going to put inside a blue winter squash, and I bought one a week before, and it was a beautiful, beautiful shaped squash and so ripe for stuffing. And then when we went to prepare it, the bottom was moldy. I can't believe it. I have bought so many squashes in my day that have lasted for my favorite subject, food, like I was just doing. Anyway, we had a great Thanksgiving. Some of the recipes that we made are at responsibleeatingandliving.com. I'll get back to that later. Right now, I want to bring on my guest because we're going to be talking about yummy food. And this time, it's food from the South, from Mississippi. I've got the Mississippi vegan on today. Timothy Parkin is a passionate cook, artist, and photographer, and the creator of the blog Mississippi Vegan. Before devoting himself to the culinary arts, he spent time as a fine artist in Charleston, South Carolina, and New York City, and he currently lives and works in New Orleans. Timothy, welcome to It's All About Food.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, I've been devouring your book.
Oh, you have? Good.
Yes. I read it all. The stories are wonderful. I wanted to say I loved Issa Chandra Mosquist's foreword. You must have loved it too. It was really lovely.
Yeah, she's such a talented writer, and she's really funny. And I mean, before I read the book, I wanted her to write the foreword. And so when she said that she would, I was really excited. And, you know, that was the last thing that was put in the book, and I felt like it really kind of tied everything in together. So I'm really, really happy with the foreword.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful book. You take beautiful photos, and the recipes, I can tell, are quite yummy.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So before we get started, I'm just curious. You lived in New York City for a while, and I understand you worked at a few vegan restaurants in New York City?
I served at a few different. Funny enough, when I started doing Mississippi, I was still working as a server, and this restaurant actually changed ownership, and I actually created the menu for it. It was really funny how that happened. But then I started doing pop-up events at different event spaces, so that's when I was working in the kitchen and serving.
Okay, so now it's your turn to break up, and I'm not quite sure why you're breaking up, but if there's anything you can do on your end, that would be nice.
Okay. So
I hear you, and then I don't hear you.
I'm trying to stay in one spot. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Okay, great. Okay. So let's move to the book. And I kind of made a list of some of the recipes I wanted to talk about that popped out to me. And the first one I want to talk about is your Mirliton corn bisque.
Yes.
And I've never used the Mirliton. I think I've seen them in Costa Rica. You've called them also chayotes.
Mm-hmm. They have a lot of different names, but in this region, they call them Mirlitons. But they have, like, if you look at their Wikipedia page, they have like 20 different names.
Yeah, I've seen them and I've never known what to do with them. So now I have a recipe, the corn bisque. And
yeah,
I'm wondering,
honestly, when
I make a corn bisque, I usually use a potato. Is this anything like a potato, or is it? What's it like?
It's like if a zucchini and a potato had a baby. So it's kind of firm, like the texture of like a, but it's a little bit more succulent and it's a little bit more juicy. And it's funny because when I made that recipe, I boiled the chunks in it with the broth, and then I was going to puree everything and eat it as like a solely pureed bisque. But the chunks were so tender and succulent, I decided to leave them, like to leave the chunks in. Could
very
do whatever,
good.
But I think once you bring it to a boil, they're really delicious. So, but I would compare it to like a zucchini.
I love it. If a potato and a zucchini had a baby, I may steal that
exactly.
from you.
Yeah, steal. You can have it.
Okay, thank you. Speaking of blending part of the soup or the stew or whatever, I want to bring up your slow-cooked red and beans rice.
Mm.
And you, after you cook it for a very long time, you blend some of it, right?
Well, what I noticed with that recipe is when I was making the recipe, because, you know, I grew up eating all this food, but it was not vegan. It was, you know, just the traditional recipe. But I remember when I made it, and I called my mom, and I was like, I don't know what I'm missing, because it doesn't have that creamy, kind of thick gravy texture. And I then realized, I researched a lot of different recipes, and yeah, the trick is to blending up some with oil, and it kind of like emulsifies and becomes like a whipped bean mixture, and then you reincorporate it, and that's what kind of gives it that kind of creamy texture. So I definitely advise not to skip that step. It's really important, and I definitely, that was kind of the missing link for me with that recipe.
Yeah, well, thanks for that secret. I love the concept because I can be confused when I'm making the soup. Do I want it to be chunky? Do I want it to be creamy? And sometimes it's nice to have both.
Yeah, totally. I think, especially with the Mirliton bisque and the red beans and rice, I think you get that like kind of velvety, luxurious texture, but then you also get some of the chunks, which is just a nice variation. So, you know, I definitely agree with you. I like to have both just for a variety of textures. I think with all my recipes, I think the more variety of texture, the more kind of pleasing the overall dish is.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of my listeners know that I go nuts over lion's mane mushroom. I have one of my favorite restaurants in California recently started putting a dish on their menu with lion's mane, and I just go nuts over it, like I said. And you have a great lion's mane mushroom mornay in your book. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, so it's so funny. When I first had lion's mane in New York, a farmer at the farmer's market was cultivating it, because you can grow it indoors. I had some, and I went home and I sauteed it in a cast iron skillet with a little bit of oil and salt and pepper. And I was just so amazed at how it had the same texture of crab meat. It just really, it's kind of like that delicately fibrous texture that crab meat has, kind of tender and kind of breaks apart. And
yeah,
when I was working on the recipes, I was thinking, what's the best way to, you know, utilize this crab meat? And my mom always made crab mornay for a Christmas party. And it was always the first thing, $100 worth of crab meat and a ton of butter and cheese and cream. And so, so I just replaced it. And the funny thing is you can use any mushroom for that sauce. It's going to be good. But if you can get lion's mane, I think there's one person that cultivates it here in New Orleans. But if you can get it, it really hits that texture, and it really satisfies that craving for crab meat in the recipe.
And a lot of the high-end mushrooms are expensive, but they can't be as expensive as crab meat. And there's no bad cost to the environment.
Totally. And what's funny about that lion's mane is I actually foraged that on the Natchez Trace Parkway. And
wow.
This is actually the season for them right now. They like it when it gets a little bit cooler. And the one thing, you know, I'm not going to advise anyone to forage wild mushrooms unless they know a lot about it. But one of the great identification factors of lion's mane is there's really no other mushroom that looks like it. So I'm not saying to necessarily consume it, but if you're just trying to ID the mushroom, lion's mane is a pretty easy one to identify because it has such a unique structure.
Yeah, it's hairy, mm-hmm. like a mane.
It is.
Yeah, it's a really funny looking mushroom. Okay, the next thing I wanted to talk about was blueberry barbecue sauce.
Yeah.
How crazy is that?
You know, it's so funny because, I mean, when I worked at a restaurant, they did a strawberry barbecue sauce. And I remember just loving it because it had that tang. And I thought blueberries would just make such a fun sauce. And if you notice in the picture, if you get the sunlight to hit it, the barbecue sauce, it has this like beautiful, like purple magenta color. So it's really fun.
Well, I'm all about food that's good for you. And blueberries are like one of the top superfoods. So anything you can put them in is a win.
Yeah, totally. I think, I agree. The color of them kind of just tells you how nutrient dense, you know, they are. So I agree. I think sneaking them into anything, even a barbecue sauce, is a win in my book.
Okay. Now this book is featuring recipes from Mississippi, some of the recipes, but we have this Southern flair to it. And I want you to take a moment and tell us about gumbo.
Okay. So gumbo was the first like recipe that I learned to make, and my mom taught me how to make it. So my mom and dad both were born and raised in New Orleans, and my mom learned to make gumbo when she was young, and that was the first recipe that I asked her to teach me. And I remember the most important things about gumbo was really taking your time making the roux and browning the flour with oil and getting it nice and toasty. And what I remember the most is when she would add the trinity, so the celery, the green bell pepper, the onions, and then eventually the garlic. And when all that hit the hot roux, the whole house just smelled so amazing. Mm. And so in my mind, that was always what I remember gumbo to be. And that ends up, you know, being the plant-based ingredients. And my other favorite thing about gumbo was that you used okra. And I've always loved okra. It's probably my favorite vegetable. So when I went vegan, it just made so much sense for me to make gumbo and just to make it how I learned to make it and just not at the end add the sausage or the chicken. And then eventually I learned that you can add, you know, large chunks of mushrooms, or you can add hearty chunks of vegetable, or you can add even a vegan sausage. And I like to add greens to mine, like kale, like shredded kale. And what I learned when I was writing the book is that the word gumbo actually means okra. And so it's been funny to hear people get confused when I say vegan gumbo. But in actuality, the reason gumbo is so special is because of the plants that we're using to make it. So it's the paprika and the cayenne pepper and the bay leaves and the onions and the bell pepper and the garlic and the flour. Those are what's making gumbo that authentic traditional recipe. And sure, people, you do add shrimp and sausage, which does affect the flavor. But that's, in my opinion, that's a small percentage of what gumbo is.
Okay, now I'm someone who has never acquired a taste for okra. I know it's very nutritious, and I really want to grow up and learn to like it. Do you have any tips? Should I just make a gumbo and just see what happens?
What I would say, the first thing you should do is try my skillet okra, because what I think people do, the mistake people make is they overcook it, and then it becomes even more slimy than it already is. Mm-hmm. So what I recommend is cooking it with really high heat and with the salt, pepper, and a splash of vinegar, just a little bit of acid to kind of give it some tang, and get it nice and crispy on the outside, but you still want it to have a hearty texture. You still want to be able to bite into it. And that's what I recommend. And if you don't like it that way, then we can just accept that you don't like okra, and it's okay.
I always like to tell people, if they say they don't like a certain food, like they don't like broccoli, it's like, okay, there are so many different foods to eat in the plant kingdom. You don't have to like all of them.
You don't have to like all of them. I mean, me personally, like, I don't like sea vegetables. They just taste too much like fish to me. So that's one, like, plant food that I don't love. But I would say in the gumbo, you could absolutely put large chunks of merlaton. That would be a beautiful vegetable to put in the gumbo. And you can also put, I know it's hard to find, but purslane. I don't know if you've ever had purslane, but it has.
I don't like purslane. It's another slimy vegetable.
Yeah. You know what I would say? I would say just avoid the slimies and use merlaton. And you know what is great in gumbo too is like, I heard you talking about that winter squash, but like large chunks of kabocha squash or butternut.
Oh, that's good.
Or honey nuts. Good in the gumbo. Yeah.
So good. Just look at the bottom and make sure it's not moldy first.
I know. You know, when you said that, I'm laughing because I have three huge ones and their decorations outside on my front porch and they're like in perfect condition.
They last forever, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, it was okay. We had too much food to begin with, and it all worked out. I wanted to thank you because when I was reading your first gumbo recipe and I realized that it had white flour in it or wheat flour in it, and I'm personally avoiding gluten and wheat for the most part, and I was thinking in my head as I'm looking at the recipe, okay, I wonder if what other flour I might use to thicken it. And then you answered my question in the next recipe, which was great. And I'm glad you did all the work.
Yeah, sorghum flour works great. You know, I've used chickpea flour, and it worked, but the chickpea flour kind of separates a little bit, and it's fine, but it doesn't have quite as smooth a texture as if you use sorghum flour. So I highly recommend sorghum flour for a gluten-free room.
Yeah, good. I love sorghum flour for many different things. It has a flavor somewhat similar to wheat, and it has a nice, mellow sweetness. And that's the plant kingdom. If you can't eat one, there are so many others that can fill in the space.
Yes. No, it's very true. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're just trying to recreate a texture and a flavor. So if we can do that with other ingredients that are easier for certain people to digest, then we should absolutely do that.
Okay. Last thing I wanted to talk about gumbo is the wooden spatula. Uh-huh. And I'm so glad you talked about the wooden spatula because I know a lot of people, they're frustrated with cooking and they don't have the time, they don't have the skills, and they don't have the tools. And wooden utensils, like a wooden spoon or a wooden spatula with a long handle is so essential.
Oh, totally. I mean, I don't know how any other way to make, I mean, you could try using a whisk, but you're probably going to burn the roux, and it's going to make it a really frustrating recipe to make. So I have quite a few wooden spatulas that are curved. I have probably like four or five. It's so funny you say that because I actually chipped off one today, and I was so upset because it was my favorite one. And so I'm on the hunt for another one because the shape of it is so perfect. It's like just long enough. And it has a really nice long edge, and I'm just so upset. But you know what? At the end of the day, it's wood. It's like it can't last forever. But a good worn down roux spoon, like wooden spatula, is I agree with you, is a essential kitchen tool.
Well, in some ways, it's like seasoned after a while. I think it makes everything just taste better. My partner, Gary, is Italian, and when he makes sauce, he's got to have a wooden spoon to make his sauce. Otherwise, it won't be good.
Yeah, no, it's those little things in cooking, the little traditions, you know, the little, things that happen over and over again that it's kind of part of the experience, and that's really what a good recipe is. It's just, you know, it's a tradition, and it's human.
Okay, Timothy, did I just lose you? Because I don't hear you anymore. I hope you're still there. I wanted to mention another recipe, or a couple of recipes, and that were the bacon recipes. The potato bacon and the mushroom rice paper bacon. Oh, my goodness.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I'm talking about your bacon recipes now, the potato bacon and the mushroom rice paper bacon.
Yeah, there's quite a few bacon recipes in the book.
Yeah, they're good. You know, I was going to thumb through the Baconish cookbook. I don't know if you've seen it, but I don't think she had these kind of recipes in her book. And as like as you mentioned in the book, we vegans like to make bacon out of everything.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think what's important, can you hear me? Are we good?
Yes, we're good.
What I would say, what's important, I think people are always perplexed, like, well, if you're vegan, why are you trying to make, why don't you just eat bacon if you want bacon? And what people need to understand is what we're craving is the experience of eating bacon. We want the texture. We want the flavor. We want something that's smoky and salty and crispy and chewy and fatty. You know, in actuality, we're not craving the pig that's alive and like living in a field somewhere. What we're craving is the end result. So I didn't go vegan because bacon was delicious. You know, I went vegan because I don't want to kill the pig. So if I can eat bacon that is made from plants or mushrooms, then I absolutely will because it's delicious.
Exactly. And that's where we're going, I think, in the 21st century, making everyone's favorite foods with plants instead of with animals. I know that when I've been in hotels that serve breakfast and they have the hot chafe covered chafing dishes and I know what's inside them, there's sausage and bacon, I can hear the screams of the pigs when I pass by. Now, I don't know where they come from, if it's all in my own subconscious or if, you know, I'm connecting to some other dimension, but I don't want to eat pig bacon because to me it looks and smells like torture, pain, suffering, and death.
Well, that's, you know, and not to turn it into such a dark conversation, but people ask me how I do it, and it's like I'm not tempted by these foods because when I see them, that's what I see. I see straight through it. And so I think what people need to do moving forward is they need to stop asking, you know, why vegans are trying to recreate things that aren't vegan and celebrate that we can recreate things and make them vegan and healthier. And we can remove the animal from it and still achieve that texture and flavor. And so when we switch it and we kind of celebrate and we just appreciate it for what it is, delicious food, then the conversation doesn't have to be like, why are you trying to do that? Like, well, you know, it doesn't have to be that. It can just be positive, you know? I think people ask me all the time, they're like, they just, you know, they ask me, you know, why I'm vegan, or they kind of want to just get in an argument with me. And I always say that my veganism is a celebration of what I do eat. You know, instead of me focusing on what I don't eat, I've already decided that I'm not going to eat animal or animal products. I'm so busy focusing on what I do eat that I wrote a whole cookbook about it, and I have a whole Instagram that's dedicated to it. And, you know, I'm just full-time eating delicious food. And that's really what veganism is to me. It's full-time eating delicious plant mushroom-based food.
I'm right there with you. And I don't like to talk much about the dark side. The dark side is out there, but I prefer to point people in the direction of the light, which is this yummy, delicious food. So I'm right there with you. It's interesting that you call yourself the Mississippi vegan. I know you're originally from Mississippi. And Mississippi, unfortunately, is one of the unhealthiest states. They could certainly use learning a little bit about how to make some traditional recipes vegan.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what happened is Mississippi just went, and just like a lot of southern states, and just were a lot of unhealthy people, the food system went in a wrong direction really quickly. And, you know, I think a lot of the unhealthy foods are coming from processed, you know, food companies, and it's like, you know, factory farm animals. That's not what I think about Mississippi. I think Mississippi, like having a backyard garden and, you know, lady peas and okra and tomatoes. And so I think, yeah, it needs a positive light shed on it, which is what I wanted to do. I felt like it was my duty to kind of show people that there are artistic, creative people that are vegan that are from Mississippi. And I think exploring the undercurrent of veganism and kind of making it relatable so that people in Mississippi, like, it doesn't need to be weird. Like, I'm still eating all the food I grew up eating. You know, I'm still celebrating all the food. But we need to focus on the healthier ingredient, and we need to make that be the foundation of our food system. And that's going to help everyone be healthy, and it's going to help the environment.
The last thing I wanted to talk about is the fact that I read your book, and I know that you're an artist, and you love preparing wonderful, beautiful food. It's a joy. It's a celebration. I understand. I love to cook. And there are so many people that don't. And maybe some of them want to. Maybe some of them watch food shows. Maybe some of them are listening to this show. I know I've heard from some of you who say you'd like to, but you don't. I always say find your kitchen. And people don't have the skills. They don't have the traditional recipes from their family. And how do we get them there? I mean, as an artist, you are living your life. And I like to say that convenience is like not living when you go for convenience. How much of your life do you want to miss? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we should be learning and experiencing and getting in the kitchen and cooking and being around people. But some people don't agree with me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I would say is I would invite everyone to go to a farmer's market and to just try to buy something there. Buy something that interests you or that you're familiar with and support a local farmer and bring it home into the kitchen. And then whatever you get, say it's a butternut squash or, you know, half a pound of okra or whatever, and then just Google, you know, a recipe or look in my book and see where it has it. And make a simple, easy recipe. I mean, you could go to the vegetable sides of my book. They're all super simple. And it's literally just as simple as roasting a vegetable with salt and pepper, maybe a little bit of vinegar, and maybe a dried herb. It just start there, and then once you make one thing that you like and that's delicious, I think it gives people that confidence, and then they want to make something else. So I think we need to instill this confidence. So by starting small, yes, and making something delicious, then it'll make people want to cook more. But at the end of the day, people have to care, you know? You have to care. If you don't care what you're eating and you don't care about making delicious food, then it's not going to be for you, you know?
Yes. Yes. Anyway, back to Mississippi Vegan. This is a lovely cookbook. You've done a fine job. The recipes are all page lickable. And I'm excited to have it, and I'm going to learn how to eat okra.
All right. Well, I really appreciate that, and that means a lot to me. And I wanted the book to be touching. And I feel like it's been touching to a lot of people, so that makes me really happy.
Yeah, the holidays are coming. This is a great gift for the holidays, or has a lot of recipes that I think would work well for your holiday table.
Yeah, it's definitely a holiday cookbook. And if any of your listeners need kind of proof of the pudding, they can look at my Instagram. It's at Mississippi Vegan, and they can see there's a whole bunch of free content for them, and maybe they can understand where I'm coming from when they see my photography.
Excellent. Timothy, thank you so much for spending some time with me today and for writing Mississippi Vegan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Well, I meant every word. I meant every bite. And I really can't wait to dip into some of these recipes. And if you're following my blog, What Vegans Eat, I will mention what recipes that I've made that come from this book, and then you can see them there as well. That's at responsibleeatingandliving.com, and the blog is called What Vegans Eat.